Good morning, everyone. If you weren't here in lecture last time, I wanted to let you know that we have changed the order of some of the topics that are on the syllabus. So we're actually going to be tackling the topics that were originally slated, I believe, for the 18th. Let me just verify that. Yes, so we're tackling section 14.1, and then the first few sections of chapter 15. And the reason I wanted to do this is because there's some really fundamental aspects of chemistry that are discussed in those sections of the chapter, and I wanted to make sure to get to those before we get to our next exam. So I know that we're jumping around a little bit. We will return back to the sections that were originally listed for the syllabus, but I wanted to leave the time to make sure that we get through these few topics in chapter 14 and 15. I also wanted to let you know that I'm going to be going just slightly beyond what's in the chapter, because like I said, they are very fundamental topics, and I'm surprised they're given as short of a discussion of the chapter as they are. So I'm going to try to see if I can find some type of web resource that would be able to help you out on these topics if you need an additional place to be able to read about them. But otherwise, I'm going to try to do as good a job as I can in lecture to really describe them so that you would be able to use my notes to study for whatever questions may come up on the exam. So last time we did start out in chapter 14 talking about water. And we had talked about why water is unusual in that it forms a solid phase that's less dense than the liquid phase. We had then started talking about specific heat, but I ran out of time to really go fully through that topic. So let me just start with, again, the definition of what specific heat is. Specific heat is the amount of energy needed to raise 1 gram of a pure substance by 1 degree Celsius or Kelvin. The reason I can say 1 degree Celsius or Kelvin is that we're talking about changes in temperature, not temperature itself. And you might remember that to convert back and forth between Celsius and Kelvin just involves adding the number 273 to the Celsius temperature. So that means if you go up 1 degree Celsius, you're also going up by 1 degree Kelvin. And so again, since this involves temperature changes, it doesn't matter whether it's Celsius or Kelvin that we're discussing. So last time, as far as I got was to say that specific heat is related to this idea that if you were in the kitchen cooking something, and if accidentally you left a pot, a pan, something made out of metal on the top of a stove versus a piece of wood, then we might have the common experience that you're more likely to get burned if you put your hand down on that pot versus the piece of wood. And that's just due to the different composition of those two objects, where the metal is able to change its temperature a lot more quickly even if the same amount of energy is put into it. And that's the idea behind specific heat. So now, if we wanted to figure out the total amount of energy that would be needed to change the temperature of some kind of object, then we can just take this definition to build up an equation, because this is the amount of energy it takes to raise a pure substance, 1 gram of that pure substance, by 1 degree Celsius. So specific heat, which is often abbreviated S, if we take that and multiply that by the mass of the sample that we have, and then we multiply by the change in temperature, then that gives us the total change in energy that's necessary. So that equation I didn't get to last time, and it's a fairly straightforward equation, again, where we just multiply the specific heat times the mass times the temperature. Now, another related concept, which let me just double check. No, it does not seem to be in here. There's another closely related term that is heat capacity. And that's the amount of energy needed to raise an object by 1 degree Celsius or Kelvin. So what's the difference between the two? Well, if we're talking about a pure substance like water, the difference is mass. That in terms of heat capacity, which could be called C, that would be the mass times the specific heat, if we're talking about a pure substance. So you might think, well, why do we need another definition like this if all we're doing is combining two of the variables? Well, what if I had an object like this laptop? There would be a certain amount of heat that we would need to add to raise this laptop by a degree Celsius, but it's not a pure substance, so we wouldn't be able to get a specific heat value out for it. But we could treat the whole object as a place where the heat's going to end up. So then if you take the heat capacity, which is for the entire object, and multiply that by the temperature change, then we get the total amount of energy that's needed to change the temperature of that object. Now, in just a little bit, I'm going to come back to using this equation again in order to show how we could determine how much energy a chemical reaction might be absorbing or giving off. So for right now, we're just talking about specific heat, but that's going to come back to us in just a moment. Now, let me just make sure. I think way back when we talked about units of measure, we might have talked about units for energy. But I bet it's been a while, so you might have forgotten what the units are. So just as a reminder, because we're going to be talking all about energy today, there are two units of energy that we commonly use. One of them is the joule. And that is the metric unit that can be derived off of other metric units. And the other one is the calorie. And there is a conversion factor that you do not need to memorize, but it's mentioned in the text, so I wanted to write it down just once, where one calorie is equal to 4.184 joules. Now, where does the definition of a calorie come from? The specific heat of water is what a calorie is defined around. So that's why it has this odd conversion between calories and joules, because we based the calorie off of the physical properties of water. Why might we have done that? Why might it have made sense to make a unit of measurement based off of water? Well, think about cooling systems. If you needed to cool off either a chemical reaction that might be going on in a refinery, if you needed to cool off an engine like in your car, then there's a lot of these systems that involve water as far as the material that does the cooling itself. And if water comes up in a lot of equations commonly, then it would make sense to have a unit of measurement based off of how water itself behaves. So that's exactly where the calorie came from. So calories are still quite commonly used, but in the lab we tend to talk about joules. So if we do any calculations later on, we'll mostly be using joules, but I just wanted to mention where the unit of measure calorie came from. So the reason this came up in the chapter on water is that water, due to its structure, ends up having a very high specific heat. Water retains a lot of energy, takes a lot of energy to heat water up. There is one other physical property of water that's mentioned in chapter 14, and that's its acid-base properties. So you already remember, hopefully, from the chapter on acids and bases that water undergoes an autoionization, that water all by itself has a fraction of its molecules that could split apart into H+ and OH-. Well, it turns out, therefore, that water can act as both an acid and a base. And so water is what is known as amphoteric. Now, this amph prefix, there's actually a couple of other English words you might have heard of before that has that same prefix in them. One of them is amphitheater, and the other one is amphibian. So does anybody know what an amphibian is, what that term refers to? Frogs. What about frogs?
They can go on land and water.
They can live in both land and water. Does anybody know what technically an amphitheater means? Like, we've heard the term, but what does it mean? Some type of facility that has both an indoor and outdoor component to it. So the prefix amphi means both. So amphoteric means a substance that can act as both an acid and a base. And that's one of the other important properties of water, that water can act as both depending on what ends up getting mixed with it. So there isn't any more detail that I need to share about this, except that that is one of the important qualities of water itself. Now, there's some other aspects of chapter 14 we may come back to at the end of the quarter, but I want to spend quite a bit of time today on chapter 15. And like I said, I wanted to go a little bit outside of what's in the textbook, because one of the concepts introduced in chapter 15 is the idea of a catalyst. And I'd really like you to have a better idea of what a catalyst really is. So in order to do that, I need to talk about energy changes in chemical reactions. And in order to do that, I want to step back and think about this kind of situation. Let's say that we have a reaction between sodium hydroxide and an organic molecule. So I'll write this out in standard Lewis dot format. This is a version of methane in which one of the hydrogens has been replaced by a bromine. And I might not have mentioned this as a functional group name, but when you have an alkane that has a halogen on it, this is what is known as a haloalkane. I might have mentioned that functional group because I might have talked about Teflon, materials where you have fluorines that are taking the place of hydrogen on organic compounds. So a haloalkane-like, this compound, is able to react with the hydroxide from sodium hydroxide. And without worrying about the details of how the reaction occurs, that hydroxide is able to kick off and displace the bromine. And part of the reason I wanted to show this example is we talked about functional groups, we talked about organic molecules, but we didn't really talk about reactions of organic molecules. And modern organic chemistry is a lot about transforming one functional group into another. So in this case, what we've done is we've taken a haloalkane and turned it into an alcohol. Specifically, this is a way that we could synthesize the molecule methanol. So it's an example of a functional group transformation, which is the basis of organic synthesis, which, in case you don't understand, why would we care about organic synthesis? Well, many of the common medications that you might eventually end up taking, most of them are organic molecules, rather large organic molecules. And to build those molecules up, we usually start with simpler sources that hopefully are available from a plant-based source or maybe a petroleum source that's cheap and plentiful and sustainable if we care about the environment. So organic chemistry there's a set of thousands and thousands of different reactions that let you manipulate these smaller molecules to change the functional groups or assemble those molecules together. So that's why I just wanted to show an example of organic synthesis. Now today, though, I want to talk about the energy changes behind chemical reactions. And so I want us to think a little bit about this. Suppose we wanted to see how energy changed as this reaction was carried out. Well, one way we could do it is to take the position of each of the atoms in this reaction and change their position by a little bit, each atom at a time. And then we could do a calculation using a computer model to figure out, well, what would the energy in that system be? And so I just want you to think in terms of coordinates, you know, like X, Y, Z coordinates. How many different coordinates would we need in order to come up with a graph that would map the energy of this chemical reaction? Which maybe that's a big question, so let me help explain what I'm asking for here. If you've got some kind of function, you know, our answer in this case is going to be how much energy is in the system. And if you take a negative charge and a positive charge and you bring them together, negative and positive charges like being closer together, and so the energy of the system would drop. Suppose, though, you took a positive charge and tried to bring it closer to another positive charge. Well, then that would be unfavorable because you're bringing like charges together, so that would cause the energy to increase. So what we could do is look at the position of each atom and try to look at, well, what would be the interaction of positive and negative charges, and therefore what would be the total energy that's in that system? Well, if you had to specify where each atom is located, how many different numbers would you need in order to do that? Like if I had just one atom, let's just check here. How many different coordinates would I need to specify the position of just one atom? Three, right? Because we are living in three-dimensional space, ignoring space-time and all that. So you'd need an x-coordinate, a y-coordinate, and a z-coordinate to say how far left and right, how far front and back, how far up and down is that atom located. In this particular example reaction, how many atoms do we have? Seven, if you count them up. We've got five on the haloalkane, and we've got two in hydroxide. So there's seven different atoms. And we'd need three coordinates for each atom to say, well, where is everything located? And then, of course, we've got this model that's going to spit out energy as an answer, which that would be a coordinate itself, or at least one aspect of this graph that we're trying to create. So in other words, you would need a 22-dimensional graph in order to plot out all the possibilities of how much energy could be in this system. And most human beings can't think in 22 dimensions. So the whole point I'm making here is this, that when a chemical reaction occurs, we make an assumption that that chemical reaction is most likely going to go according to the most energetically favorable pathway. Like, if we were going from here to Santa Cruz, we're probably going to go over Highway 17 because that's a path that's already been carved out for us, whether you're driving or biking or whatever. It would take a heck of a lot more energy to go any other method because you'd be going up more, up and down more hills. So imagine that atoms do the same thing, that when they react, they try to react in this, such a way where they use the least amount of energy possible. And so what ends up happening is we can develop a graph that looks like this. That suppose we have the energy of the reactants, and we look at how those participate in a chemical reaction along the most likely pathway. And so what that ends up being called is the reaction coordinate. We take all those different coordinates for all the different atoms and squish them down into just one variable. And we say, okay, the reaction just goes forward, like in a line. And then we say, well, how does energy change during that chemical reaction? So in the specific reaction I showed you, the diagram ends up looking something like this. So reaction coordinate, to put it simply, is the pathway that a reaction will take. And then we look at the energy changes as that reaction goes forward, and we end up starting with the reactants and end up at the products. So there's a few aspects of this diagram I'd like to point out, and I don't believe this diagram is in the chapter at all. Let me just double check and take another look, because I honestly don't remember at this point. It looks like it's not. So there is a reason for this diagram that'll become clear in just a little while. So first off, if we look at the difference in energy between reactants and products, that is something known as the heat of reaction. Which I might have talked about what heat is way back when we were doing units of measure. So heat is the transfer of energy from one object to another. And it involves normally a change in temperature, or it could involve a change in phase. The symbol for this heat of reaction uses the symbol H, which H naturally stands for heat. So this delta means change, and that's the change in heat of reaction. And most reactions, in order for them to be favorable, they need to release energy, so to go downhill. Question?
So this is why humans produce heat while living. Is this part of the reason why? It's a bit of a digression, but...
I have to think about that. I guess you could say that yes, in whatever way that the cells react, the cells take in oxygen, a reaction occurs, energy ends up being released, and some of that excess energy ends up being released in the form of heat from humans. So I guess you could say so.
So does that have to do with like warm-blooded,
cold-blooded animals? That's something separate,
okay.
Which I'm not really qualified to talk about that difference. But let's stay... stick with chemical reactions just for the moment. So in this example I've shown you, this would be a reaction that does end up releasing heat. Now, notice that there is some position here, though, in between the reactants and products that's actually higher than energy than either one of the reactants or products. And that amount of energy that it takes to get up to the top of that hill, that is something known as activation energy. And that is the amount of energy needed to initiate a chemical reaction. So I can give you a very easy, common, everyday example of where activation energy comes in. Imagine that you are going to light a match. You know that in order to light a match, you have to strike it against some kind of rough surface, and then you'll get this puff of smoke, you'll get a spark, and then the match will light. And once you've done that, once you've added that energy in, of course the match is going to end up burning on its own. That's exactly the type of situation going on in this diagram here. I mean, you could stare at that match all day long, and unless you got superpowers, which means you probably wouldn't be here, that match is not going to burst into flames on its own. You have to add that amount of energy in, even though we all know that once it's lit, the match is going to burn. Question?
Is activation energy the same thing as the threshold required in action potentials for neurons firing?
I Yes, it would be kind of similar to that. Yes, the question was just asked, would that be anything like the action potentials that that cause a neuron to then fire? There is some kind of, I don't know enough about biochemistry or biomechanics to answer that fully, but I'm guessing that's a similar situation, where even if that neuron wants to fire, it takes some input of energy first to start that process out. So I'm guessing here that, yes, that would be something similar.
Is this a, like an all or nothing thing? Like that threshold has to be reached in order for there to be...
Yes. If you don't get up to that threshold, the reaction won't occur. If you want to think of a real-life situation, it might be something like a water ride or something like that. You know that once you get over that hill, as long as the ride is designed correctly, that you're going to end up all the way at the bottom. But if you don't get over that hill, you don't go over the ride at all. So activation energy is critical for chemical reactions to occur. Now, the top of the hill, just because I've already developed the rest of this diagram, let me point out that the top of the hill is known as the transition state. So the transition state is where you're not reactants, you're not products. Like bonds maybe have started to break, but have not completely broken apart. Bonds may be starting to form, but maybe not have completely formed yet. So you're in this intermediate state that is higher in energy than either the reactants or products. So the activation energy is what you need to get up to that highest point, and then the reaction can occur. So we're going to come back to this diagram in just a moment, but now I want to get into some of the information that is in chapter 15 directly, because the chapter touches on the topic of thermodynamics, which is the study of energy changes in chemical reactions or in physical processes as well. So, the study of energy changes in a chemical reaction. There are what are known as the laws of thermodynamics, one of which is easy to understand, and so I'd like to start with that. It's what is known as the first law of thermodynamics. And I'm going to state it in a way that makes more sense than the rigid way that we might define it. The first law says this. That energy can neither be created nor destroyed. But it can change form. Now, let me explain a little bit more about that and introduce a little bit of terminology. In thermodynamics, we often define what is known as a system. And to keep it simple, a system is nothing more than a frame of reference. So if you're talking about a chemical reaction, you could talk about just those chemicals that are reacting. Or if it's appropriate, you can include the container that the chemicals are sitting in. Or, depending on what you're doing in terms of calculations, you might worry about the room that the chemicals are in, or the building that the chemicals are in, or the whole city. Whatever your frame of reference is, whatever that reaction or process is that you're talking about, you call that the system. And then there's the surroundings, which is everything that is not included in the system. Now, in theory, there's different types of systems, and one of them is known as an isolated system. And that's a system in which neither energy nor matter can cross the boundaries. Of that system. And the reason I want to give you a little bit of this terminology is, one, the ideas of the system and surroundings are mentioned in the chapter. But if you have the concept of a system, and more specifically an isolated system, like a pocket in space cut off from the rest of the universe, then it lets me talk more about the first law of thermodynamics. Because in an isolated system, the total amount of energy is constant, which means if we wanted to write it out in mathematical form, delta E, the change in energy, is equal to zero. Now, let me take the concept of specific heat and apply it here to help explain what specific heat could be used for. Let's say that you've got a cup that contains a certain amount of water. Let's just say 100 milliliters of water at 25 degrees Celsius. Let's say that you had a hot piece of metal. Iron, for example. So let's say that you have a 5-gram cube of iron. Fe is the symbol for iron. And let's say you heat it up to 200 degrees Celsius. A very simple question might be, what would the final temperature of this whole system be once you drop the piece of metal into the cup? That might be an important engineering question if you had like a computer design where you had a chip that was going to get up to a certain temperature and you needed to make sure that you dissipate all that heat in order to keep from the chip from failing. Of course, we're not talking about chips here, but similar type of situation. What if you needed to do this calculation of heat? Well, here's the way that we tackle a problem like that. We pretend that this cup is its own isolated system. Now, that's not really true. We know that the cup's going to be in contact with the counter it's sitting on. You've got the air around it, and that means that there's going to be some heat loss or gain in real life. But let's pretend for a moment that this cup acts like a perfect system. So what we could do is say like this. If the cup is treated as a perfect system, then that means the total amount of energy change that's going to go on is equal to zero. That's what the first law says, that if you have some region of space, unless something crosses barriers in that space, you're not going to be able to change the total energy content that's there. But you can change what format that energy is in. Like if you had a battery that could power a motor. Well, that energy that was stored in the battery could be used to convert into mechanical motion. In this case, if you're taking a hot object and putting it into a cold object, there's going to be heat that flows from the hot object to the cold object. But that means we could set up an equation like this. We could say that the change in heat of the metal plus the change in the heat of the water is going to add up to zero if you're treating this as an isolated system. And then we already have an equation that we could use to figure out, well, how much energy change is going on for the metal? How much energy change is going on for the water? And we could substitute. We could say that the specific heat of the metal times the mass of the metal times the change in temperature that the metal is going to go through. We could add that to the product of the specific heat of water, the specific or the mass of water that we've got in the cup here, and the temperature change that the water undergoes, which all that should add up to zero. So we could look up in a table what the specific heat of iron is. We already know the mass of iron because I've given that to you, and at least we know the starting temperature for the iron. We already know what the specific heat of water is. We know the volume of water, which you could use density to figure out the mass of water, and we know the starting temperature of the water. So the only thing that's missing is what the final temperature is. And there's a way we could solve that from this equation. So this whole process that I'm discussing is what is known as calorimetry. Calorimetry is measurement of heat changes. And in this simple example, I'm talking about measuring the heat changes due to hot and cold objects being exposed to each other. Now, what if instead of a hot piece of metal, I have a chemical reaction going on? Well, I can use this the same process to figure out what the energy change in a chemical reaction is. That if I had a chemical reaction going on in the water is going to change temperature. And because I know the properties of water, I could measure its mass, I could measure its specific heat, I could figure out what that temperature change is, I could figure out how much energy the water is absorbing or releasing. And if I have a perfectly designed system, like imagine this is a styrofoam cup, imagine a super thick styrofoam cup, imagine a metal case device that's as isolated from the outside world as possible, where it's kind of true that the only energy change that will happen in the water is due to a chemical reaction, then that lets me measure the heat in a chemical reaction. That's how we can determine what the heat of reaction is. So back to this diagram I was drawing earlier. If we want to know what the heat of reaction is, there's a process for doing that that involves specific heat, that concept from chapter 14, and then it involves the first law of thermodynamics, this concept that's from chapter 15. That's why I put those two chapters together in the same day in the syllabus, because I knew eventually I wanted to talk about this topic. So let me write down a little bit what I've talked about, because like I said, a lot of these smaller details are not mentioned in the chapter. So calorimetry is the process of measuring energy changes in a physical or chemical reaction. I say physical because the example I developed here was just a piece of metal going into water, which there's no chemical reaction that's going to go on. The water is not going to change identity. The metal's not going to change identity. There's just heat transfer being involved. But by using the first law, calorimetry can be used to measure energy changes in chemical reactions. So as the chapter talks about these energy changes, you might think, well, how could we figure out what they are? So I've shown a method where you could do that. And even when I was a chemistry major, an undergraduate, we did this kind of experiment. It was fancier than the styrofoam cup I referred to, but same type of concept, a chamber that's isolated from the outside world. You do a chemical reaction in that chamber, and there's water surrounding it that absorbs that energy. If you can find out the temperature change in the water, you can then find out how much energy that chemical reaction gave off. And it's, again, all based on the first law. Yes? So there's lots of things we could do to try to make this as close to an idealized, isolated system as possible. So, yes, ideally you'd want something that's either in a vacuum or something where the temperature of the entire system is well maintained by some kind of external device. So when we did this as an undergraduate, we had this big, huge tank of water that was on the outside of this calorimeter. And the water was constantly running at a constant temperature to make sure that the outside environment wasn't having any influence on what the inside was doing. So that was one way of trying to mimic this idea of an isolated system. Now, this next topic is pretty heavy theoretical. I'm going to just admit that in advance. But if you can understand what's going on behind this topic, it's another major aspect of chemical reactions. So I want to start with a physical example first to help get us there. Suppose that we're standing here at De Anza. And let's say that the only way, that, especially for those of you who came to class today, the only way that you can survive the fact that you have a 7:30 chemistry class is large doses of caffeine. So let's say that you stopped at, well, let's see, Coffee Society doesn't exist anymore, does it? So let's say it's good old Starbucks that you had to visit on the way here. I could ask you, how far is it from that Starbucks to here at De Anza? And there's two ways you could answer that question. You could say, well, the proverbial shortest distance between any two points is a straight line, right? But is that the way that you were able to go from Starbucks here? No, of course not. Not unless you were driving through neighborhoods and through the campus itself, right? So there's a difference between what the literal distance is and then the path that you actually traveled, which your individual path may be different depending on which roads you take, whether you walked, bike, took a car, bus, whatever. Your path may be different. So these are two different quantities that are involved, the literal difference between just the positions and then the path that you really took. So in really technical terms, this first distance, this would be displacement, the distance between two points. And the technical concept behind this is what is known as a state function. So a state function is a function the value of which does not depend on how a process occurs. But only on the initial and final states. I know that sounds kind of technical, but that's why I wanted to have a nice concrete physical example to talk about. That this distance between De Anza and Starbucks, unless the earthquake hits today, the ground opens up and the fault separates these two places in space, that distance is not ever going to change. That distance stays constant. No matter how you might walk between the two points, the real physical distance between here and Starbucks is always going to be the same. And it only depends on where's De Anza located, Where is Starbucks located? Where is the beginning point? Where is the end point? That's one type of function. Of course, then we have the distance traveled. Which, of course, is going to depend on how you move from one point to another. So there's another type of function called a path function. And I know that math gets painful. And if I didn't make this bad joke before, then, well, I'll make it now. If you think about the words that you're not supposed to say in English in polite company, a lot of them have four letters in them. So we have this phrase of four-letter word. And then how many letters is there in the word math? Which is why for many people math is a four-letter word. Which is the way that people tend to think about math. So I know I'm going heavy mathematical for a moment, but there's a point to all this that you just got to trust that I'm going to get there. And I saw a couple hands go up, and I'll come back for your questions in just a second. So a path function, what is that? A function that entirely depends on how a process occurs and not necessarily on its start, on its initial and final states. So in this example, there's a minimum distance. Unless you can warp through space, you can't get from one point to the other any shorter than the distance between the two points, but you sure could take a heck of a lot longer distance to get between the points. So state functions don't depend on how processes occur. Path functions do. Now, before I make my next point, let me grab some of these questions. Yes. Yes. And if any of you get to mathematics to the point where you end up taking calculus, there are things known as integrals. And there's a difference between integrals of state functions and differences of integrals in path functions. They call them path integrals. So I know that might be a long way off in terms of mathematics. Here's the point for chemical reactions. Energy changes in chemical reactions are state functions. What does that mean? That means the change in energy only depends on the identity of the reactants and products. Not how a chemical reaction occurs. Why do we care? Because remember, at some point I want to introduce what a catalyst is. And you might have already heard somewhere in a past class that a catalyst is something that speeds up a chemical reaction. We're going to get to that. That's going to be the end result of our discussion. You might say, well, why don't you just tell us that? Because I want you to have a little bit deeper understanding of what a catalyst does so that I could talk about catalysts in a few different situations. So we're going to be using these energy diagrams like what I showed you here earlier, showing energy changes from reactants and products. And in this particular diagram, I happen to show an energy change that follows some particular pathway. Well, let's say that I had a different way of doing this chemical reaction that had five steps in it instead of one. It doesn't matter how many steps I take to do the chemical reaction. The total difference in energy only matters what are the reactants, what are the products. So no matter which pathway I follow, I'm going to get the same overall result. You might think, that's nice. What does that matter? Well, imagine that chemical reactions did depend on how they occurred. So, for example, if you move your hand left versus if you move your hand right, what if those two different processes had a different energy content to it? There'd be no predictable outcome for any kind of chemical reaction, which I know it seems like I'm making a big jump, but then there would be nothing that a set of molecules could do that you could predict the outcome of. Meaning there would be no biological reaction that would have any kind of predictable outcome. And so there'd be no kind of system that could develop that would have an expected outcome. So presumably that would be there would be no kind of life because everything would be completely random. But we have cells that can depend on metabolism. We have processes that can depend on oxygen reacting with things to get predictable results, no matter how those chemical reactions occur. So it's a very fundamental concept, I know, a very deep concept, but it's one that's going to come up in just a moment, well, after our break, actually, where we do talk about catalysts. And in the full chemistry class, a Chem 1 class, this ends up being a very central concept. That chemical reactions, their energy changes, don't depend on how they occur. They matter depend on what are your reactants and what are your products. That is the concept of a state function. So I know I've gone more heavily theoretical than I have in a while, so let me just summarize what I've talked about today. I started out with a much simpler topic, which is on specific heat and heat capacity. And that's related just to measuring changes in energy, that you can take a pure substance and come up with a concrete number to say how much energy is it going to take to change the energy of that substance. That's what specific heat is related to. Then I started jumping around in thermodynamics, and I introduced this idea of the first law of thermodynamics. First law basically says you can't win. You can't create energy out of where energy didn't exist before. But you can change what form that energy comes in. So that's why I started talking about systems and surroundings. Because the term system is just as fundamental in thermodynamics as any other concept is. Because if you're talking about changes in energy, you have to figure out, well, what boundaries are you talking about? If this energy is being released, where is it being released from? Where is it going to? So we have to put a boundary around something and say, that's our system. That's the thing we're talking about. And usually it's a chemical reaction that is our system. But chemical reactions, that's even more abstract than talking about water and metal and objects we can touch. So then I talked about this cup example of how could we measure energy changes when things interact. Well, the first thing we have to do is pretend, or in real life come up with systems that come as close to this as possible, pretend that we've got this system where no energy can escape from, no energy can come into. That's where the first law applies, because you can't create energy where it didn't exist before. But that means we have an equation that we can work from. We know there's going to be no overall change in energy, but we could see how things change energy inside that system. And so I took the idea that, okay, you have a hot piece of metal being dropped in the water. The hot piece of metal is going to lose energy. It's going to have a negative change in temperature. The water is going to gain energy. It's going to have a positive change in temperature. And once the whole process is over, the metal's going to have lost energy, the water's going to have gained energy, but that's all going to add up to zero, which lets us solve for what's going to be the temperature? And then we can extend that to say we can measure the energy changes in chemical reactions. But once we started talking about chemical reactions, that's why I went off on the deep end and started talking about state functions. Because if you're talking about energy changes in chemical reactions, an important concept is that it doesn't matter what you do to get that chemical reaction to work, as long as you know where you start, the reactants, as long as you know where you end up, that's what's going to determine the energy change in a chemical reaction. Now, we've hit our break time, but did anybody have any questions before we take our break? Because I'm going to start putting more pieces of this puzzle together once we get back from our break. Continuing on with thermodynamics, let me come back to some more practical terminology. And we're going to be back in the textbook now. So chemical reactions can absorb energy or they can release energy. And we have terms for each one of those. So there's the term exothermic, which means a process that releases energy. And in numerical terms, what that means is you have a change in energy that's negative. So this is part of the reason for having this definition of what a system is. Because if you talk about energy being released, maybe you might conceptualize that as a positive number. You know, the stuff around you gets hotter because the energy is being absorbed by it. But what's releasing the energy? Well, the chemical reaction itself. And so from the perspective of the chemical reaction, it's going to end up at lower energy. And that's the perspective we always take. We always look at the system and how the system is changing. So when you talk about an exothermic process, that means something that has a negative energy change because you're talking about the thing itself losing energy. The opposite would be an endothermic process. That's a process that absorbs energy. Which, again, if you're talking about a chemical reaction, a system of some sorts, if it's absorbing energy, then it's got more energy. And so that's a process in which the energy change is greater than zero. Now, your text talks about a different way of coming up with how to figure out what an energy change in a chemical reaction is. And I want to use the same example here just so I can follow along in the text for this part. So it talks about the fact that if you take hydrogen gas and chlorine gas and react the two of them, that you can end up with hydrogen chloride, which when it's not part of water, then it's not hydrochloric acid, it's just the molecule hydrogen chloride. So we could do this reaction in some kind of fancy container, something that could hold the gases, let the reaction occur, heat could be given off, we could have it surrounded by water and do calorimetry, figure out how much energy water that's surrounding it absorbs, and then we can go backwards and figure out, well, how much energy did the chemical reaction give off? But there's another way to do it, which is to recognize this, that in this chemical reaction, we have hydrogen-hydrogen bonds that are breaking. Because if we have hydrogen in this natural form of H2, those are two atoms covalently bonded together. How can we know it's a covalent bond? It's the same atom combined with itself, so they have equal electronegativity. And if you have equal electronegativity, that means you're going to have a covalent bond. Same thing going on with the chlorine. Chlorine in its natural form exists as a molecule. And so if you want it to react, then you're going to have chlorine-chlorine bonds that are also being broken. And once you separate out the chlorines and the hydrogens, then they're going to be combining together. So then you have hydrogen-chlorine bonds that are forming. Now, one of these sets of processes, and you notice I've got two different colors going on, one of those processes is exothermic, and one of those processes is endothermic. Which one do you think is which?
Breaking is
exothermic? You had a 50-50 chance, right? So breaking bonds is actually an endothermic process. And then forming bonds is an exothermic process. Takes energy to break the bond. And let me try to give you, I know I've been really theoretical today, so I hate to do something else too theoretically, so let me try to be quick with this one. Imagine that you had two hydrogen atoms that start out infinitely apart from each other, and you let those hydrogen atoms start to approach each other. Then we can come up with a graph that looks like this, where if we're talking about the hydrogen-hydrogen distance, when those two atoms are infinitely apart from each other, they don't experience any interaction with each other. But as those atoms start to get closer to each other, you can imagine the nucleus of one atom, which remember the nucleus is positively charged, could start to experience some interactions with the electrons from the other atom, and vice versa. The nucleus of the other atom starts experiencing interactions with the electrons from the first. And if you bring positive and negative charge closer to each other, then you get the energy start to drop. Of course, if you squish the atoms too close to each other, eventually the electrons from one start bumping into the electrons with the other. And if you really get the atoms packed on top of each other, then you're trying to squish the two nuclei together, which means you're trying to squish positive charge with positive charge. And if you bring like charges together, then that increases the energy of the system. Now, this ends up being an incomplete picture because electrons are not dots. They actually act like waves, so they're spread out over these things called orbitals. So the real story is a little bit more complicated. But for hydrogen, this actually works out pretty well to tell us how this is going to behave. And so notice that when the hydrogens come together, they release energy. So in order to get those hydrogens back apart again, in order to break the bond, we have to add that energy back in. And so this is a picture that helps explain the fact that to break a bond, and I'll write this out in text form, to break a bond costs energy because bonds form in order to lower energy. The whole reason two atoms would come together in the first place is if they end up in a better energy situation afterwards than when they started. So if a bond forming ends up releasing energy, then to break a bond always costs energy. So that means you have to add energy to the bond, and so that's an endothermic process. So over here, after the atoms have split up and we put them back together again, that ends up being an exothermic process. So if we wanted to, we could figure out what's the energy change for breaking the bonds for hydrogen? What's the energy for breaking the bonds for chlorine? How much energy do we get back when we put the hydrogens and chlorines together? And so your text actually does that calculation as an example. So we have the hydrogen-hydrogen bond breaking, and there's one mole of hydrogen involved. Then we have the chlorine-chlorine bonds breaking, and there's one mole of that involved. And then we have two moles of hydrogen-chlorine bonds forming. So the value that it gives you for the hydrogen bonds breaking, I'm sorry, hydrogen-hydrogen bonds, because we already have a definition of this thing called a hydrogen bond, so that can get confusing if I'm not careful. So this number ends up being 432 kilojoules per mole of hydrogen. Then for chlorine, that ends up being a weaker bond. It's only 243 kilojoules per mole. Then to form the bond, notice that it's a negative sign. This is why I was talking about positive and negative numbers earlier. We have to have some standard way we talk about energy changes. So over here where energy is being absorbed, those are both positive numbers. Here where energy is being released, it's a negative number. And it's 2 times 427 kilojoules per mole. And so overall, this ends up being a process that has an energy change of negative 179 kilojoules per mole. No, you don't have to memorize these numbers. Yes, if I ask you a question about it, I would give you the information. And here's the important point. Does this overall process end up being exothermic or endothermic? This is exothermic. Now, a question could be, well, how were these energies measured in the first place? Well, that's another question. But here's one reason why I was talking about state functions earlier. Because we don't really know how this reaction occurs. Maybe the reaction is more complicated than just bonds get broken, bonds get formed. Maybe they form some strange kind of complex as they react. But it doesn't matter, because since chemical reactions, energy changes, or state functions, it doesn't matter how they react. That matters is where do we start, where do we end up, and it doesn't matter how we get between the 2 points. So if we want to pretend that the hydrogen bonds just break, that the chlorine bonds just break, that HCl just forms, that's fine. Because this value you get is going to be the same no matter how we approach the chemical reaction. So that's why we're allowed to just use bond energies to calculate what's going on here. We could do calorimetry. It's going to give us the same result. It doesn't matter how we measure the energy change. It's always going to end up the same. And that's part of the point of mentioning what a state function is. So this discussion about endothermic and exothermic and bond changes, this part's straight out of the text, just to reassure you a little bit. And that's where the text gets to in terms of thermodynamics. That's the text's goal, is to get to what endothermic and exothermic are and to talk about how could we calculate energy changes. Then the text moves on to another topic, which is kinetics. That is the study of how reactions occur and how quickly reactions occur. Now, here's an example I often use to differentiate between thermodynamics and kinetics. You might have heard ads on TV before that say things like diamonds are forever, which is absolutely completely false. If we could sit around long enough and watch a diamond, it will fall apart into a pile of graphite. Which, does anybody know how diamonds are formed originally? Tons of pressure, right? You have poor dinosaurs or plants from millions of years ago that were under the ground and have all this extreme pressure of all the ground above it for thousands or millions of years or however long it takes. So you have all this force that's crushing the carbon together in order to form a diamond. Well, what do you think happens when all that pressure is released? It's going to fall apart again. Anybody ever see a diamond fall apart? No, because it takes an equally long time for it to fall apart again. That's the point of kinetics. Kinetics is how do these processes occur? How long does it take them to occur? Why does it take them so long or such a short time to occur? So it turns out to be very difficult for diamond to fall back apart again. That doesn't mean it won't happen. It's exothermic for it to fall apart again, but it takes time for it to fall apart again. That's the difference between kinetics and thermodynamics. Now, what affects the rates of reaction? The rate of a chemical reaction normally depends on three things, really, besides how the reaction occurs. So, no, I guess I should include that too. So the rate of a chemical reaction normally depends on how the reaction occurs. That's number one. Number two, the temperature that the reaction's occurring at, the concentration of reagents, and, well, this one's kind of related to the first one, the activation energy. Now, that first part is tough to talk about. We'd really have to go deeper than I really should for this course. So I will hold off on that unless we get a place where I think we can do it in a way that will end up making sense. So there's what's known as a mechanism of a reaction, which is step by step how the process occurs. And I can give you a little bit of a hint of that. But no, maybe for given how much time we have left today, I'll skip over it for now. So then the temperature of reaction, how is that related? Do you all remember me talking about energy distribution graphs? This was back when we were talking about the auto-ionization of water. And I had said, well, how is it that water is going to break apart all on its own? And then I sidetracked and I said, well, why is it that water can evaporate at room temperature if it's nowhere near its boiling point, right? And I drew a graph that looks something like this. I said, at low temperature, here's what the energy distribution in some kind of liquid or gas is going to look like. That you'll have some molecules that are moving more slowly, some molecules that are moving more quickly. And as the temperature changes, that distribution is also going to change. So the x-axis here was energy per molecule, and the y-axis was how many molecules have that amount of energy. So now I'm going to put a line on this graph. And let's say that is activation energy. Remember, I talked about activation energy earlier being that energy you have to add in order to even get a chemical reaction to occur. So at low temperature, I could shade in and say, here's the fraction of molecules that would have enough energy for the reaction to occur. But as you increase temperature, heck of a lot more molecules would have enough energy to undergo exactly that same process, which it's bad for me to talk too much about biology because I'm not a trained biologist, wasn't my major. But imagine the process of food going bad. Why do we put stuff in the refrigerator? Is there something magic about how cold stops bugs? Well, no, it's magic in that cold stops chemical reactions. You drop temperature down, and the same chemical reactions that still have that same energy barrier, fewer molecules have the energy to get over that barrier. So whatever the process is for something decomposing, it's slowed down because the reaction is slowed down. You heat something up, more molecules have the energy to do whatever process is going on. And so that's why temperature has a huge effect on rate of reaction.
Above a certain temperature, it won't react anymore also, or is it just, it doesn't matter?
So to get a little bit deeper, if you have reactions that are reversible, both the forward and the reverse reactions become more possible as temperature goes up. So then it depends on whether the reaction's endothermic or exothermic. But that's getting a little too detailed. But that's a good question. So I'll say it this way, that as temperature increases, more molecules have enough energy to pass over the activation energy. What I just said hopefully makes some sense, and that's why I took the time to explain what is an activation energy. Now, I said that activation energy itself can have an effect on a chemical reaction. And there's another version of the same graph that could be used to demonstrate that. So let's say that we're at one temperature now. Let's say we're at room temperature. So we have some distribution of molecule energy. So here's energy per molecule again. And let's look at the number of molecules. Let's say that you have a process that has a low energy barrier. So a low activation energy. Let's say we have some other process at the same temperature that has a really high activation energy. Well, look at the fraction of molecules that we would have in each case. For the high activation energy, that means not as much molecules have the energy to pass over that barrier. But if you have a low activation energy, heck of a lot more molecules would have the energy to pass over it. So the higher the activation energy, the fewer molecules that have that energy, and so the lower rate of reaction. And I should come back and add one more line to the paragraph up above here. I said as temperature increases, more molecules have enough energy to pass over the activation energy. So the faster the reaction. This last factor is concentration. Why should concentration matter for chemical reactions? Well, let's say that we've got a solution with just a few molecules in it. What's those chance that the molecules are going to bump in together and react with each other? Probably pretty low if there's not very many that are around. What if you've got a solution filled with molecules? Well, a lot more collisions are going on. And that's what determines the rate of a chemical reaction. How many times can the molecules bump into each other? And then what fraction of that collision is going to be successful. You know, two molecules can bump into each other, but if they don't have that activation energy, nothing will happen. But if they don't bump in together in the first place, then nothing can really happen. So the higher the concentration of a solution, the more chance that molecules will collide, and the higher the rate of reaction. So now, I can finally get around to really talking about what is a catalyst. And you might be thinking, thank goodness at this point. Here's what a catalyst does. A catalyst doesn't just push a reaction along faster. It causes a different reaction pathway to occur. So that reaction coordinate diagram I drew at the beginning of the class, we needed for this reason. That I could talk about a chemical process that might have one possible pathway, which means it's got one activation energy that goes along with it. This abbreviation EA, E stands for energy, A stands for activation. So put the two together, you get activation energy. And this is the uncatalyzed version of a reaction. Just an example. Not all reaction curves look like this. This is a simple one. But here's what a catalyzed reaction might look like. It might have a different and more complicated pathway. But here's the point. It has a lower activation energy. Now, what I said just a moment ago is that if you have a lower activation energy, you have more molecules that have the energy to be able to do whatever process it is. And so automatically, the reaction rate picks up. So a catalyst is a substance that provides an alternative reaction pathway that has a lower activation energy. Which allows a reaction to occur at a faster rate. Oh, now I've got to be good and remember to put in my labels here, reactants and products. Notice what's not different in this picture. The energy of the reactants doesn't change. The energy of the products doesn't change. Why? Because chemical reactions happen according to state functions. It doesn't matter how the chemical reaction occurs. It doesn't matter how many steps or hills there are. All that matters in determining the total energy change is what was the energy of the reactants, what was the energy of the products. So because a catalyst does not change the identity of the reactants or products, a catalyst won't produce more products, it will just produce them more quickly. That was the point of me mentioning state functions, to say that catalysts don't affect how much you're going to make, because it doesn't change the energy that's involved, because it doesn't change the identity of the reactants or products. Question, yes?
So this is about the environment that the reaction occurs in, right? Essentially, the changes that
It changes the environment. Now, I give you a very specific example. Well, let me give you a specific example of a catalyst that's not hyper-technical, something that's easy to understand. We talked about saturated and unsaturated fats, right? And I might have mentioned what hydrogenated oils are, or maybe I didn't. Let me show you an example organic reaction. If you take something that has double bonds in it and react it with hydrogen, hydrogen will react with the double bonds to turn them into single bonds. So more specifically, the hydrogen will break apart and it'll form new bonds with carbons. So instead of there being a carbon-carbon double bond, it will go back and make a new carbon-hydrogen bond on each of the carbons that used to be part of the double bond. This process happens super slow if all you do is try to mix the organic compound with hydrogen. Why? It's a physical problem. Most organic substances that we would do this reaction with are either solids or liquids. But hydrogen, of course, is a gas. So how do you get these two different substances and force them together to react? You add a catalyst. Like platinum or palladium. Why does that help? Because what happens is on the surface of the metal, when hydrogen happens to pass over it, all by its own, it will break the hydrogen apart. That's the difficult part in getting hydrogen react, is making the hydrogen-hydrogen bond break. So when hydrogen gas passes over the metal surface of a catalyst, the hydrogen splits apart on its own. And then later on, when the alkene comes along, hydrogen's already been broken apart, so the alkene much more easily reacts with the hydrogen. That's just one example of what happens in a catalyst. This is similar to what happens in what's called a catalytic converter. Those of you who have non-electric cars, non-hydrogen cars, you have good old-fashioned gas-burning cars. If you've got a properly working car, you've got a catalytic converter in your tailpipe. Anybody ever had your tailpipe stolen for any reason? I've heard of cases of that happening before. Why? Because most of them contain platinum or palladium or other really expensive metals. And so what someone will do is they'll steal the tailpipe assembly, scrape the metal out of it, try to recycle it, get some money back out of it. Happens from time to time. It's not an easy process, not the most efficient type of a theft out there, but it happens. And it's because of the metal that's in this catalytic converter, which is doing the same type of thing, that as the nitrogen oxide or other byproducts of the combustion of the fuel, one of the major products being carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide is poisonous. But as it passes through this catalytic converter, it speeds up the process of those compounds being turned into other things like carbon dioxide, which is not toxic. I mean, we can't breathe it and survive, but it won't be actively hazardous like carbon monoxide. So that's one place where catalysis is used all the time in automobiles. And of course, then there's biological versions of catalysts, which are called enzymes. So that's how an enzyme works. And in fact, just to let you know, now that we're finished with this discussion of chapter 14 and 15, I've decided we're going to continue right on to chapter 16, because chapter 16 is the chapter on biological molecules. And I've made lots of references to biological molecules in talking about organic chemistry. I've brought up enzymes several times, and enzymes are one of the topics that's in chapter 16. So I thought, let's do something logical and continue that flow, and we'll move on to chapter 16 next. But let me wrap up again what I've talked about with a catalyst. Let me just repeat the main points here. A catalyst does something like this platinum metal. It provides some kind of way for a reaction to occur more easily, and more specifically what it does is it reduces this activation barrier, the amount of energy it takes just to start a chemical reaction. That means more molecules are going to have enough energy at the same temperature to get over that barrier, which means the reaction moves more quickly, which is the whole point of a catalyst. So, your text does talk about reaction rates. It doesn't go into as deep of a level as this, but it talks about catalysts, it talks about concentration. I added in this discussion of activation energy because it just makes a heck of a lot more sense. There's one other topic in this chapter that we're going to talk about a little bit today, and then we'll move on and come back to it, because to me, it's the single most difficult topic in all of chemistry. And you might think, what? You mean, aside from everything else you've already talked about, there's something that's even more difficult? Yeah, to me. Very, very fundamental concept. So imagine that these were both chalk erasers instead of dry board erasers. If I were to clap the two chalk erasers together, what's going to happen? Big cloud of dust, right? Is there any chance that that cloud of dust is magically going to reassemble itself onto the two erasers? Of course there's a chance. It's one in a billion, 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 billion. It'll never happen in the life of the universe, but there's a chance, right? But it's more likely that those molecules are going to spread out in space. That's a physical process. Turns out the same thing's true with energy, that energy does not tend to concentrate itself. It tends to spread itself out. And this concept has a word that's associated with it, which is entropy. Very frequently in texts, when they first bring up the concept of entropy, you get this idea of disorder, that entropy is disorder. But it's more than that. Entropy is the tendency of both matter and energy to become more spread out. In these last few minutes of class, I want to present an example that we're not going to have time to fully discuss, but I just want to get you thinking. This lecture may have made you do a lot more thinking today than we've done recently. That's not such a bad thing, actually. But let's imagine this. If I take sodium hydroxide, solid sodium hydroxide, and throw it into water, the water gets hot. Why? Well, because it took energy to pull sodium hydroxide apart. Sodium hydroxide is an ionic substance. So remember when we talked about solutions, what happens when substances go into solution? Those ions have to be pulled apart from each other, but then those ions are going to get surrounded by water. And it turns out that it's very favorable for sodium and hydroxide to interact with water. A lot of energy gets released by water surrounding those ions. Enough energy gets released that it's more energy than what it takes to pull the ions apart. And so when you put sodium hydroxide in water, the water gets hot. And that's because from the perspective of sodium hydroxide, that process of dissolving is exothermic. Right? Okay. If you take ammonium nitrate as just an example, and you throw it into water, the water gets cold. So what does that mean? That means it took more energy to pull ammonium and nitrate apart than the amount of energy that gets released again when water molecules surround those two ions. So it took more energy to break them apart. So that energy came from the water, which is why the water got cold. Now, do things roll uphill or downhill? That might seem like a silly question, but it's directly related. Chemical reactions happen when energy gets released. Chemical reactions will not happen on their own if they require energy to be absorbed. But I just described a process of energy being absorbed. You throw this ammonium nitrate in water and it gets cold. But it happens. It dissolves. It disappears. How can that process happen if it ended up requiring energy? And the answer is entropy. That in a solid form, when all those ions are packed together, that's very low entropy. That you have a lot of order. You have concentration of matter, concentration of energy. When you throw that ionic substance in water, it breaks apart. You make a mess. You spread energy around. You spread matter around. And that process of spreading things out makes up for the fact that as a reaction, it has to absorb energy. So when we were talking about endothermic and exothermic, it's really only part of the picture. This entropy ends up having a huge effect. And there are two more laws of thermodynamics. I had an instructor once that broke the three laws down like this. You can't win, you can't break even, you can't break out of the game, which you might have heard that phrase in some other context. So what are the three laws? You can't win. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. You can't break even. All real processes have entropy. Some amount of energy in any process automatically goes into matter spreading around, energy spreading around. You might have heard of the concept of a perpetual motion machine, which can't exist. Why not? Because any moving parts will automatically have friction. Friction is energy being spread around. It's entropy. So all real processes have entropy. So you can't break even. You can't break out of the game. Entropy of the universe is constantly increasing. Another way of saying it is all real processes involve energy, entropy increasing. Entropy is a heavy-duty fundamental concept. One that I'm not going to be able to successfully describe today. So entropy will be the last thing in this chapter that we finish up when we have a bit more time. We finished all of chapter 15 that we're going to discuss for now. So next class, we're moving on to chapter 16.